For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. This episode features Janine Roth, the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Women, Food, and God. With Sounds True, Janine has released an online course and the audio program, When Food is Food and Love is Love, a step-by-step spiritual program to break free from emotional eating. Welcome, Janine, to this episode of the Self-Acceptance Project. And it's so wonderful to get to be with you in person. All of the other episodes are actually being filmed from a distance. And here we are together by chance. And how wonderful. Thank you.
I love it, too. I always love seeing you. So it's good.
Self-acceptance. I know this is something you've worked with a lot, with your students and your workshops, and also with yourself. And so what I'm curious about is to know how you help people work with, we could call it the voice inside the head that says really terrible things to us a lot, for a lot of people. That voice that says, you're too this, you're too that, you're too fat, you shouldn't have said that, you shouldn't have done that. You have something, you know, on your face. You know what I'm talking about. How do you work with that?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to normalize it and for everyone to realize they're not alone. Everybody's got that voice. Some people have it a lot more vicious than others. I don't even know if that's correct English. Mm-hmm. Some people's voice is directed out there, and they're constantly criticizing other people. Some people's mode is in here. For me, it's been a constant challenge because of my particular development. It's been inner directed. I have been down on myself, or was very down on myself. And one of the ways that I found to work with it is, as I just said, to normalize it. The other way is to become aware of it and disengage. Now, I know that sounds difficult to do, but to disidentify with it, there it is again. Mm-hmm. And to hear it, but actually experience that this is just your mind, just a part of your mind, a developmental part of your mind. You could call it the superego that everybody's got by the time they're 4 years old. And if you crumple under it, if you collapse under it, then you're sort of you have obeyed its dictates, but you don't have to do that. Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing you've mentioned, recognizing how universal it is, that really doesn't actually make me feel all that better. It makes me just think, wow, what's going on inside all of the people I meet? The level of pain that people are in. It doesn't necessarily help me, but it does make me maybe look at people through a kinder lens to see how much people are suffering.
You know, what I was taught is that we each, because of the process of ego development, we start by listening to our parents. Look, we have to learn somehow not to put our hands in the fire and not to run out in the street. Otherwise, we'll get run over. We have to learn how to not to throw food on tables when we go out with other people. So we learn how to be upstanding citizens according to our parents. So there's an external authority saying to us, don't do this. You're wrong if you do this. And if on top of that, our parents are depressed or one of them is sick and we're too much and we have too much energy, then we also learn their response is pipe down. You're too much. So it starts as something external. Don't put your hands in your nose. Don't throw food. Don't go running out in the street. Don't talk to me like that. Don't have so much energy. It starts out there. And in order to survive, and in order not to keep making, this is in a developmental way, upsetting our parents and risking rejection, we internalize that voice so that it no longer has to come from outside. It's now coming from inside. So all that has to happen is the impulse to do something that we might have gotten criticized for, just the impulse to express ourselves, to say what you need, to say what you want, and it gets quashed down. No, don't do that. You can't do that. You'll lose love if you do that. The whole thing gets internalized, and that part becomes unconscious, and all we feel, we don't remember our parents told us not to do that. It wasn't okay to do that. We feel like, I can't. I'll get in trouble. I'm wrong. I'm bad. I'm damaged. I'm too sensitive. I'm too overwhelming. I want too much. I'm dumb. I'm a failure. And that's what we walk around with. So in the sense that everybody's got it, because everybody's got an ego, everybody has to go through the stages of human development, and that's part of ego development. So I think that normalizes it. I mean, maybe that doesn't make you feel better. I think the hard part for all of us is to be able to understand that when we listen to it, we collapse, we feel small, we feel weak. If we believe it rather than disengage from it, then we're sort of lost.
Okay, so talk to me about this process of disengaging. How do you do that?
Yes. Well, what I usually do is realize that this is what I used to do. I'm not in the grip of this anymore, but because I've practiced this for so long, I'll tell you what I did. I realized, wow, something has just happened. 10 minutes ago, I was sailing along and everything was fine, and now I feel awful about myself. Now I feel weak, or I feel collapsed, or I feel bad, or I feel like a failure, or I feel like nothing is ever going to be right again. What happened? So what's my first flag is the feeling that I feel weak or collapsed, diminished. Then I sort of go backwards and I say, okay, what happened? What am I saying to myself right now? How am I speaking to myself? What am I saying to myself? What helps people, I think, in the beginning is to put it in the you form. Because if I just sat here with you and said, Tammy, I can't believe that you just did that. I can't believe and that's the voice. You know, I'll often ask people when they come to a retreat or a workshop, write down 10 criticisms you've made about yourself in the last half an hour. And they can write down 100. And then I'll say, okay, now please tell me what those criticisms are in the voice that you talk to yourself in. And they are shocked because the voice is, who do you think you are? You are disgusting. How could you have worn those socks today? What makes you think that you're going to get anything out of this thing? And when people become aware that they would not talk to anybody else like that, and they wouldn't let anybody else talk to them like that, and they become aware that this is going on with them all the time, they feel compassionate, they feel sad, they feel shocked, and they feel much more willing to become aware of the entire mechanism, to make the whole thing conscious, And once you make it conscious, and if you say it in you form and not in I form, I'm so damaged, I'm a failure, I'm never going to get this right, I'm never going to get enlightened, I'm never going to stop eating compulsively. If you say it in you form, then you're aware that internally, this is called an object relation, there's a big one and a little one. And the big one is, and the little one is going, oh, I'm sorry, you're right, I'm a failure. And then you can actually say, is that true? Is it true? Usually the things I say to myself when I'm caught in the grip, they're not true. They're things I heard. They're things that I once believed about myself. For instance, you're a failure. I mean, I can say it to myself, and I feel like a failure, like I've never done anything in my life.
Yeah.
And I can say, is that true? Really? Or another way, so let me give you a couple of ways of working with this. One way is it true? The first step is you have to become aware that it's going on.
Yeah.
That's the first, because with the awareness, you have a choice. With that choice, you can then take an action. And the action can be, is it true? The action can be agreeing with it with some kind of humor. You know what? You know, sometimes with the students that I work with, you ate so much. I can't believe you ate that much. And I'll often say to them, say to that voice, you think this is a lot? You should have seen what I ate for dinner last night. And or you should see what I'm about to eat. So because with humor, that's another disengagement, another disidentification. Mm-hmm. So you do it with humor. The point is to disengage, to disidentify, so that you are no longer taking that to be you. Mm-hmm. And when you do that with humor, or when you do that by, this is the third way, which works for some people and doesn't work for other people, you say, shut the hell up. You use the aggression that that voice is using against you, because it's an aggressive, violent voice. There's violence and viciousness in that voice. If you use that back, then there can be a disengagement. Then you can start actually feeling your own strength, your own courage, your own willingness to say, stop, you can't talk to me like that.
Now, some of the people in this series have said that sometimes that voice can carry useful information. That can, you know, and so if we just say, you know, shut up, we might not be learning from some message that that voice is trying to bring us, albeit not very skillfully by being so aggressive and harsh, but there still might be some intelligence in it. What do you think about that?
I think that the problem with this voice when you listen to it is that there can be objective truth in there, but what happens is that objective truth gets merged with moral judgment. And so it's the judgment of it that is so painful. Yeah. So that voice can say to me, you have gained 10 pounds and you are such a loser. And it's the loser part that makes me feel defeated, collapsed, weak. Usually there's some kind of energetic diminishment, either on the physical level or on the emotional level. So there's some kind of smallness that happens because of the moral judgment. If there's objective truth to it, without moral judgment, you've gained 10 pounds, or, you know, when we lost all of our money and we had put it all in one place, really a four-year-old knew not to put all their money in one place. I mean, you know, seriously. But if I had said, you idiot, you did this, that blocks any change from happening. That moral judgment, the attack of that, blocks you from having any kind of clarity, any kind of spaciousness, any kind of curiosity of, oh, right, I put all my money in one place, or, right, I've been eating a lot recently, what's been going on? But if I feel like I'm a loser and I'm a failure and I'm damaged forever, then all I'm going to want to do is hide. I'm not going to be interested in the objective truth in there. So I think there can be objectivity without the cruelty.
Now, speaking of the Madoff scandal where you did lose all of your money that you'd put in one place, did you hear that voice telling you, the voice of what an idiot, how could you, and then how did you disengage? I would imagine that could have been so intense, such a strong inner criticism coming out.
I heard it immediately. After the shock wore off, after the first couple of hours wore off of, wow, then the ranting started. And it started first by blaming myself, and then it went to blaming everybody who was involved, my husband, our financial advisor, our accountant, my friends. And then I realized that if I listened to that, I could not tolerate being in my own skin, that I had to stop that judgment, that was imperative. And this is the value of a disaster. I wouldn't recommend this, but the value of a disaster or of a huge collapse happening, a financial collapse happening, an illness, is that you see your mind the way your mind works. And my mind was so compelled towards judging myself, and yet the judgment itself was making it intolerable to live in my own skin because it was so extreme. Because we had lost everything, I couldn't sleep at night unless I found another way. And so I became vigilant about stopping the judgment. And when you have to, and I felt like I had to because I couldn't have slept at night. My husband was away, and I was faced with the truth of it every day. I didn't know how. Or I didn't know how we were going to live or what we were going to do. And so the immediacy of having to stop that voice became so apparent, and the urgency of it became apparent. That's when I learned that it's actually possible to stop it. And if it's important enough, we're so used to it, we've become acclimated to it.
Yeah.
So that with a disaster, it ups the ante. And because I couldn't tolerate it, I had to stop it. And stopping it feels like freedom. It feels, when you stop that voice, it feels like the rest of your life is free. That, at least it does to me, when that voice isn't on me all the time.
And do you remember what technique you used at that point?
I do, very, very, very clearly. I brought myself back to the present moment. it's not rocket science, and it's the teaching of our time. I kept bringing myself back over and over and over again. I started with, what have I not lost? Because I was so on the track of what have I lost and the disaster of having lost that much, it was what have I not lost and what do I have enough of? And when I started looking around at what I had enough of, so it was sort of like in those old LPs where you put a needle on the record. I had to lift the needle off. I just had to pick it up and take it off that record. The new LP was, what do I have enough of? And there was so much that I had enough of that when I was vigilant about paying attention to that, the voice that, and it's a rant. And I think that voice originally was designed for self-protection. I really want to say that.
Yeah.
It was designed for self-protection.
You mean designed in?
Designed so that a kid doesn't put their hand in a fire.
Yeah.
Designed so that we don't go running around in the street. Designed so that we become able to enculturate. So it's designed for that. We internalize, it's sort of a coalescing of external authority figures, I see it, into an internal voice that thinks it knows what you should do, when you should do it, how much you should do. And the problem is, you're never good enough with that voice. So it has to be stopped. I see that it has to be stopped.
Now, you said something very interesting earlier in our conversation here. You said that this whole situation, the voice in the head that's so aggressive, doesn't plague you in the way that it used to in your life.
Yes.
And so this, of course, is very interesting to me, because for people who suffer a lot from this type of self-aggression, you're here, sitting here saying, you know, you can make a change in your life, and your life will progress, and it won't even occur as often, it sounds to me.
Well, when it occurs, my immediate response, as soon as I catch it, and I catch it either because, as I said before, I feel terrible about myself, and I know that 10 minutes ago or a half an hour ago I wasn't, or I can just hear it. I can hear the familiar refrain. Stephen Levine used to call it the top 10 tunes that you play.
Yeah.
And so I can hear the refrain. How could you? Why did you? Why don't you? When are you going to, little Missy? You know, it's like that. And I take a breath. There it is. It's like, oh, there you are again. And so this is where the kindness comes in for me. It's taken me a while to have some compassion for that voice and for myself. Because the way I see it now, and I don't know if this is true or not, I have no idea if this is true, that voice has tones of how I was spoken to as a kid. And so if I'm speaking to myself like that, I say to myself, oh, sweetheart. I call it the oh, sweetie practice. I say, oh, sweetie, I'm so sorry that you're talking to yourself like this. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry that it was like that for you. And, you know, if I want to go all the way back and I remember particular things my mother said to me, I can actually start feeling a lot of compassion for my mother, because I know that she was talked to like that because of her mother. So I can start to just go all the way back and feel like, wow, this is a legacy of how people talk to themselves, learn from how they were talked to. And it just keeps going back and back and back. And for me, after disengaging, kindness is the next step, is the, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. And, oh, ow, that hurts. You know, when I realize that I'm talking to myself the way that I'm talking to myself, which is that I'm slime or, you know, just lower than low, then, and I get it there, and there's a sort of recognition, then I start feeling compassion. Then I start feeling like, oh no, ow, it hurts to be talked to like that. And so there's compassion for myself, for as the one who's getting talked to like that. There's compassion. This sounds a little bit more conceptual than it is, because it's got to be a felt sense. You know, it's not, okay, no, I'm going to have compassion for my mother and I'm going to have compassion for that voice. There's really a recognition that this comes from somewhere. It doesn't come from nowhere. And there's a sense of, oh, I'm so sorry that it's like this.
But now, would you say that this negative voice just doesn't come up as much, or that now you know how to work with it? So it's not so much that it's not occurring, it's that now you know how to work with it.
It's not either or. I would say that it comes up less frequently, and when I recognize it, I'm able to catch it much sooner. So that a couple of years ago, maybe more than a couple of years ago, I could be under its spell and entranced by it for days, if not weeks. And just walking around feeling really bad about myself. And when you're under the grip of this, when you're entranced by this, then at least for me, it's like I felt shot through with holes. then if you were somebody I came into contact with, I would want you to tell me that I was okay, because there'd be no sense of presence. There'd be no sense of containment. There'd be no sense of myself. I wouldn't be centered. I just would be, wow, I'm a failure.
So Janine, just one final question, because when it comes to self-acceptance, I think one of the most challenging areas for a lot of people has to do with their body image, with, you know, I'm fine, I can call myself, oh sweetie, in terms of a lot of different situations in my life, but when it comes to the, you know, size of my hips, that's just no, oh sweetie, it's oh fatty, or whatever. So what do you have to say, because I know this is an area, of course, that has been one of such expertise for you, you've worked for so many years, to people where self-acceptance in relationship to body image is really their hardest spot?
The first thing that I have to say to that is, how does it work for you to reject yourself? It doesn't. I mean, I think that you sort of, people are somehow hypnotized by this belief that if they reject and shame and deprive themselves enough, they will end up happy, loving, self-accepting people. And thin, also. So what I say over and over again is that the means to the end cannot be separated from the end. If you shame and deprive yourself into losing weight, you will end up a shamed and deprived person who might also have thin hips for 10 minutes. The shame and the deprivation will lead to more eating, and you'll gain all the weight back. So the process itself is the goal. I think kindness is the name of the game here, all the way through. Is it hard? Yes. Do we learn that easily? No. Do many people model that? No. Does self-rejection and shame and punishment and guilt and fear work on any level for any kind of long-lasting change? No. And everybody who's ever been on a diet knows that.
Janine Roth, part of the Self-Acceptance Project, thank you so much. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.